Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
Hello, my wonderful listeners. What a pleasure that I can get on the radio once a week and just have all of you out there listening. It's like having a big conference, but I'm here in front of my computer on my microphone, and you're there, and I'm just envisioning you as this great big conference I get to talk to every week. Thank you for being there, and thank you for caring about the issues that we talk about each week on PRN. Oh, and don't forget to do that thing where you go to the archives or you go to YouTubes and you like or push a button that says you appreciate this show. Apparently that really, really matters. A couple of other thoughts. Plan ahead for next year. I think it's going to be one of the most interesting conferences I've ever done. Co-producing this with Bertram Karen a year from now at Michigan State University. Bert was Psychologist of the Year, an establishment psychologist who is nonetheless a man of huge dignity, courage, and truthfulness. And it's going to be April 17th, 18th, and 19th on the campus at Michigan State University in East Lansing, Michigan. Plan ahead. One of the real treats is going to be a half a day presentations by the folks who have developed and are bringing to the U.S. Open Dialogue, the wonderful Finnish program that has virtually abolished the diagnosis of schizophrenia in Lapland by going into the families and helping folks when they first start to run into trouble almost entirely, certainly mostly without any psychiatric drugs. I also want to mention my book, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, subtitle is A Guide for Prescribers, Therapists, Patients, and Their Families, which should include most of my listening audience or almost any listening audience when you think about patients and their families on psychiatric drugs. It's probably most people in the U.S. I'm sure most people in the U.S. certainly have a family member on these drugs. I wouldn't be surprised if it's up around three quarters or more of the families in the U.S. Well, we're still discounting that book, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal. And you can go to Bregan.com and get a signed copy. I'm reminded of this because every few days I'm signing copies that go out around the world. So the first half of that book, by the way, has the most up-to-date critique there is of psychiatric drugs. First half just kind of summarizes basic principles and basic facts about psychiatric drugs, drawing on all my previous work and previous books. So it's a good, basic, general book. And then it discusses the not always easy problem of withdrawing from psychiatric drugs. So now to my guest, expeditiously, quickly to my guest, Martha Rosenberg. Martha, are you there?
Yes, I am, Dr. Bregan. Hi.
Hi. Oh, you sound so bright and cheery. Listen, folks, Martha Rosenberg is one of like a handful of people in the country, I think, and I mean literally six or fewer, who is actually an investigative reporter who looks at, among many things, other things as well, the problems surrounding psychiatric drugs and also drug addiction, who is really a principled, fearless, honest investigative reporter. I don't know how many you can name like that. There are really only a very small number, and mostly they come on my show once in a while. So it's really a pleasure to have Martha here. And when she and I were talking, but by the way, just for the record, her work gets published in lots of places, Consumer's Digest, major newspapers like the Boston Globe and the San Francisco Chronicle and L.A. Times and so on, Newsday. And this I didn't know. She serves as an editorial cartoonist at the Evanston Roundtable. Maybe she can tell us what that is. She's done an expose on junk food called Born with a Junk Food Deficiency, How Flax, Quacks, and Hacks Pimp the Public Health. How's that? Born with a Junk Food Deficiency, How Flax, Quacks, and Hacks Pimp the Public Health. Wow. And, you know, there's just a lot of good stuff about Martha Rosenberg that you can easily find on the web. Well, when we were talking before the start of the show earlier in the day, started talking about drug addiction, and I figured I'd nod off, and right away instead I'm going, well, I didn't know that, Martha, and I didn't know that, Martha, and I didn't know that, Martha. So, Martha Rosenberg, welcome to the show, and tell me more things I don't know and my wonderful audience doesn't know about drug addiction. And then we'll go on and talk about other stuff, too.
Well, thank you so much for your kind words, Dr. Bregan. And I have to admit that I feel the same about you, an uncorruptible, sane voice in a sea of corruption. And I loved your last book about withdrawing from the psychiatric drugs, and I did review it, but this was a little while ago. And I found it very valuable and also very disturbing because people are put on these drugs so cavalierly, and then it takes so much to get them off these drugs. So thank you for your work.
Thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate that. So you were telling me all kinds of interesting things about vaccines and other bizarre goings-on in the world of drug addiction.
Well, yes. I mean, there's a lot just going on there, and most of it's not so good, in my opinion. In 2010, I attended the American Psychiatric Association meeting in New Orleans, and speaking at the meeting was Nora Volko, who is the head of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, and she announced to the press there that they're working very intensely on vaccines or a vaccine to treat drug addiction and alcoholism. You know, and my jaw kind of dropped because, first of all, there's a lot of profiteering going on in vaccines in general, but that her pursuit of the vaccine or the whole NIDA's pursuit is from a biological perspective of addiction, which many of us who work in this field know it isn't a question of giving somebody a vaccine. And so as I began writing and researching what they're doing, you know, it became more and more disturbing because the 12-step anonymous fellowships, which would be your Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, Cocaine Anonymous, and there's other ones for gambling and eating and things like that. But the wonderful thing about them is that they're free. And it's peer support, it's anonymous, and Big Pharma is not in there. So when I heard about this vaccine, you know, I just saw cash register signs. I thought right away, are you trying to monetize a route to recovery and sobriety that's traditionally been free? And so that was the first thing that really disturbed me. And then second, this lady, I guess it would be Dr. Volko, is credited with the quote-unquote revelation that addiction is not a moral failure. And she's actually called by the press kind of a visionary to say that. Well, again, those of us who are familiar with the 12 steps know that Bill Wilson said that in 1935. And, you know, it's not a moral sickness, that this is a disease. And that the treatment is peer support and helping others. And the treatment is not pharmacological ever. And so to see this monetized and turned into a vaccine campaign, you know, I found that very upsetting, and I've been writing about it and examining, you know, what exactly is going on. And apparently some some medical specialists and researchers have also objected to how much NIDA is putting into this ill-conceived vaccine. And evidently, there's a group called College on Problems of Drug Dependence, and evidently she had to defend the money being spent on this on that website, because I'm certainly not the only one who is very concerned with this. And another reason, if I'm not, you know, keeping you from answering back on this, if I is the whole issue of when and how you treat somebody who's not exhibiting symptoms, because she has said in her different speeches that there's a genetic predisposition. If your mother had this addiction, you know, you're at risk too. Well, we know that vaccines and drugs marketed for at-risk people is a money machine. We never know if they really would have developed the symptomatology, and they are afraid to go off the drug because they don't know if it's working. And so the at-risk thing, if I'm at risk for drug addiction or alcoholism, you know, that's a pretty brave new world if you're going to treat me before I have symptoms. And then there's one more reason why it's ill-conceived, which is that, you know, when you're drinking or drugging until you hit a bottom, it's fun. So you're not going to say to someone, I want a vaccine to stop partying. You know, so that's why Anabuse didn't work. So there's many reasons it's a waste of federal dollars. It's an insult to the addict and alcohol communities, because this lady clearly doesn't even know what she's dealing with.
Wow. Now, listen, the model for, unless I'm forgotten, medical school training, I mean, the model for a vaccine is you stimulate the immune system to attack a pathogen or some other, you know, some destructive agent and get rid of it. I suppose there are other models, but what kind of model are they imagining that a vaccine is going to work for?
Well, you know, that is certainly a medical question that I couldn't even answer. I mean, that's beyond, you know, like the joke says, that's above my pay scale. You know?
I really doubt that, Martha. They're just not even discussing their model, apparently, then. I mean, if you don't know about it, they're just not. I mean, because I can't see what the model would be.
Well, here's another objection that a lot of us have to this. What they're using to test this vaccine is primates. And, you know, we kind of know that they don't really suffer from, they're not on skid row. And I even have a cartoon where one doctor or one researcher is saying to the other one, well, the test animals didn't kill themselves. And the other one says, well, they didn't have depression either. I mean, to recreate what is a spiritual, social, and physical disease, which is addiction to alcoholism, in primates, is, first of all, that can't even be done. But the vaccines are being developed with non-human primates.
This is a great puzzle to me. I think it would be interesting to maybe you and I could do something together in looking at what the model is. If you could find for me what the biological model is that they're working on and get in touch with me about it, maybe we could do a blog together or something about it, or you could do the blog. But I think we should take a look at what in the world sort of a biological model are they imagining. Now, you know, the blue book says, and I think entirely metaphorically, the big AA book, you know, we can't drink. We have an allergy to alcohol. We're allergic to alcohol. They didn't mean that literally. And it sounds like she's making it literally. It's an allergy. That means it's an autoimmune, an immune disorder. What are they going to do? I mean, it makes no sense at all. One of the things about AA that is so wonderful is that while it isn't morally judgmental, it demands a sweeping moral change in ourselves, the AA model. You know, it begins by telling us we should that we can't handle this problem, we should give it up to God, which I think is essentially a great model for all of our issues. which is essentially ask God's help in lifting off what we cannot ourselves handle well. And it so clearly requires in the 12 steps that you take a sweeping moral inventory and really look at the harm you've done, make amends. Providing making amends isn't going to harm other people that you're making amends to. I mean, it's just filled with moral initiatives and very clearly, I think even the idea that it's a disease is a metaphor, because I think the founders clearly believed that this was a moral and spiritual issue. I'm not sure what you think about that, Martha.
Well, it's certainly referred to as a soul sickness, you know, in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. But, you know, what's really notable about that is, first of all, as you say, the self-searching. And we often hear people in the fellowships talk about if there were a pill, they wouldn't take it, because in order to treat this addiction or this alcoholism, you have to live a better life. And you wouldn't, if you had a pill, you wouldn't be a better person. And so you're right. It's a lot of soul searching. You know, it's also, I always think when you hear about the millions of miracles in these rooms of anonymous fellowships, it's also proof that, quote unquote, talk therapy works. When you see lives turned around through nothing more than each other, you know, the support of other
yes.
people.
Yes.
So it's really a big disproof of Big Pharma's, you know, fix-it mentality, you know, its whole biological tinkering. But it is, they say it's spiritual but not religious. And I've heard it, I think that there's been studies, and you would probably know this, where people have done PET scans after like a talk therapy and found brain morphological changes in a brain just from the talk experience. Does that sound at all correct?
Yeah, but I think most of that is BS. I think it's mm-hmm. fake neuroscience, neuromania. There's a lot of books critical of it. I don't think that makes sense. But listen, anything that we experience is affecting our brain. That's a truism. As you and I talk, our little molecules are oscillating like crazy, and I'm sure mine are oscillating at a higher level than usual. People will tell. In fact, I'm really happy to be talking to you, and I'm sure everything's perking at a higher rate than usual in my brain. And I'm sure that I'm going to lay down new memories and have new thoughts and ideas, so there's going to be a reflection in the neuroscience of my brain of anything that I'm doing, petting mm-hmm. my dog or getting mm-hmm. mad or getting happy. So I don't think that that's a good. I think that people go overboard with the neuroscience. It's just a mm-hmm. fact is that, of course, you know, we carry on through our brains, whether we're just living in them or whether we are them. I think we're living in them. You know, we carry on with our brains. But actually, things like recovery and growth and development are whole brain processes. Mm-hmm. Everything from our brain stem on up through our front lobes and back to our cerebellum are involved mm-hmm. in everything we do. And there's no way at the present time that brain scans can tell, give us an inkling of what that process is about.
Right, so. Right. They can't capture. And, you know, there's another point, too, Dr. Bregan, which is that a reason that these 12 steps work so well is social, because people who've been isolated, they don't have the people skills, they don't even like people, they have the high, you know, self-consciousness, they become socialized with like-minded people. And, you know, if a vaccine did work, it's not going to give you that social aspect, which is so much a part of recovery.
Well, absolutely. I mean, AA is a community. I mean, it's a fellowship. It's called, they call it a fellowship. I've been to meetings. Mm-hmm. I've had a number of family members whose lives were just vastly changed and improved. And certainly the big start for their improvement had a lot to do with AA. So I'm a big believer in it. And when I read the 12 steps, I'm happy to live my life in the same way. And I'm happy to encourage my clients, friends, and family to live their lives in the same way. And it is. It's a lot about community and about your own moral your own moral development. And there's been a constant attempt to corrupt it by psychiatry. Mm-hmm. I think in particular from having AA meetings in hospital environments, mm-hmm. There's been a selling to the AA community that they really have biochemical imbalances, so it's okay to take psychiatric drugs, even though a lot of them are nothing more than the same addictive substances they took in the beginning, such as the benzos and the stimulants. So, but, the only way a vaccine is going to work, is by doing something that harms the brain. Because the only way that psychiatric interventions work is by taking a piece out of our brains, by disrupting biochemical processes, mm-hmm. by making people apathetic, indifferent, by causing mm-hmm. lobotomy-like effects, sometimes by causing brief euphorias, like the stimulants, the antidepressants can cause brief euphorias, but eventually they too just cause an anesthesia. That's how all psychiatric interventions work. They harm the brain, and for the soul who is suffering, and I do understand this in my heart, for the soul who is suffering, it's easy to believe that anesthesia is your best or last resort when it simply is not. It's a downhill course. So any vaccine they're developing that they're getting, quote, an effect from is simply going to be one more way right. of injuring the human brain. It's terrifying.
Well, it is. And it also sounds really non-voluntary. I mean, I could actually imagine a letter to a parent, you know, dear Mrs. Jones, your toddler or your first grader is exhibiting signs of addiction, and we think he has a genetic profile, and we'd like to give him this vaccine. I mean, it's very brave new worldy, and I've heard from at several recovery places and rehab for-profit rehab centers that there is a monetizing going on there too, where you can keep your patient here longer if you can diagnose him as bipolar with, general anxiety disorder and general depression, something that would justify $800, $900, $1,000 a month prescriptions. So Big Pharma is very much in recovery and not in a good way.
Absolutely. What more have you learned about this? Have you covered pretty much the most important points about this whole idea of a vaccine? Is there more? I mean, Volkow is a very powerful woman. She and she's a scientist. She publishes papers on PET scans.
I don't mean to attack her as a person, but as a leader, I do have to mention that she's co-authored papers with Big Pharma. And I just always wonder, why is my government, who my taxes go to, in bed with Big Pharma? I mean, it just makes me sick.
Yeah, there is a huge connection there. And, she should know better. She's published a paper quite some time way back showing that the effects of cocaine and amphetamine and methylphenidate on the brain were all basically the same. She was looking at the metabolism, the main difference. I mean, they all of these drugs, from Ritalin, which is methylphenidate, to Adderall, which is the amphetamine, to cocaine, they all entered the brain in basically the same areas and had the same general effects grossly. The main difference being that cocaine came in faster and left quicker, which was more like it being hit with a hammer than a soft padded club. And yet she doesn't jump from that and say, guys, we're just going to be addicting our children. I've got mm-hmm. the data here. It's just like cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
You can't
right,
even
exactly.
tell the difference. So she's a scientist, but she's not in her conclusions.
Well, I totally concur with you. And one experiment she did on some poor little monkey that was pregnant revealed the astonishing fact that the fetus gets the drug too. I have to admit I'm very against a lot of the research that goes on against animals because of how stupid some of it is, like the one I just mentioned. But it isn't, you're right, it also is not scientific. And you've mentioned a little while ago that there's not much difference between the street drugs and the Big Pharma drugs. And you have to wonder, are they just trying to crowd in on the on the market? You know, is this just searching for money? If you're an addict and now you're on some kind of psychiatric drug that has some of the same effects in your mood, really, what's happened there? Well, the dealer's lost money and Big Pharma's gotten it, you know?
Yeah, I think, you know, people have opined that the reason that we put up with the attack on the tobacco industry was to, you know, free up more people to have to turn to proprietary drugs, prescription drugs, and, of course, even to prescription drugs to replace your tobacco with. Has anybody connected, you know, I'm trying to think back, connected the war on drugs, and I certainly don't want illegal drugs flooding America, but has anybody connected the war on drugs to the war on giving psychiatric drugs to people?
Very good point. And, you know, something else that I'm just starting to report on, and I've never over these years reported on it at all yet, is the whole opiate OxyContin stuff. And I'm pretty new to it, but after about an hour of digging, it's readily apparent that Big Pharma is how these drugs got out there, because many of the guidelines were changed, and especially I'm thinking of the geriatric people who have more pain. Guidelines were changed to make opiate, synthetic or natural opiate drugs a drug of first choice before the NSAIDs. And that, you know, so I guess what I'm saying is both the street and the pill problem was very much churned by Big Pharma for profit, and it worked. And they now say 17,000 people a year are dying from the opiate-related drugs. This wasn't the case until the guidelines were changed, and the pill mills opened up in Florida and that type of thing.
Tell us about the guideline changes, Martha.
Well, I don't have the paper in front of me, but the source, which is a great newspaper on these issues, is Milwaukee Sentinel Journal, or Journal Sentinel. And the reporter, John Fober, is very informed on how this epidemic happened. And as I say, I'm pretty new to it. But guidelines, what I think occurred maybe the last 5 years was that the reason for the pills, the pain requirements became less, so that suddenly your opiate drugs could be used for moderate pain, and they weren't, you know, of course, originally it was for hospice and cancer pain and surgery, accidents, and it became like, well, I have a migraine, you know, so the guidelines were loosened, and of course, we all know what happened. And so that I believe that this whole thing was created by Big Pharma.
Well, there is billions of dollars in Big Pharma looking for a place to encourage the making of more and more billions of dollars. We're seeing how huge their market is and their ability to generate money by the fact that when they get hit with a $1 billion fine from the federal government, everybody's happy. The federal government gets $1 billion. They only pay $1 billion, and then they go out and make multiple billion dollars. It is just a huge taking advantage of human nature that goes on with the pharmaceutical industry, especially the part I know best, which is the psychiatric portion. Now, you have wider knowledge than I do about what goes on outside the psychiatric drug industry. And when we come back, I think that there'll be some interesting areas that you may want to pick up on. What are a couple of those, Martha, before we go to break, that you might pick up on when we come back?
Yeah, I'd very much like to talk about the military suicides and the malaria drug Larium, which Sergeant Robert Bales, who killed the Afghan civilians, was on.
Yes.
So I'd really like to talk about that when we come back.
I'm talking with Martha Rosenberg. She's very easy to Google. She is an investigative reporter and does a good job. Thank you. We'll be back with Martha after the break. And this is Dr. Peter Breggin. And once again, the break, I get to listen to the little ads and statements, and I'm reminded just what to say, which is don't forget to rate the show on iTunes. Also, don't forget that we're still selling psychiatric drug withdrawal as a discount and with signed copies on Breggin.com. Breggin.com. And Martha, I hear you snorfling or laughing in the background at me. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. And again, your book was excellent. I recommend it to anybody who wants to know more about these things we're talking about.
Thank you. That was all unsolicited, folks. I really do appreciate that. It was unexpected. Thank you. Well, pick up on larium.
And okay.
How,
yes.
It's got a really. It's really a dangerous drug. At one point, at least, routinely given to people in the military.
Well, you know what? I'd like to begin with the military suicides and then work into the larium because I think it's bigger than larium. As everyone is probably aware, suicides in our armed forces have been very, very high probably the last 8 years. And they've actually exceeded who died in active duty. The military, and especially the Army, acknowledges that 60% of the suicide victims never saw combat and 30% never even deployed. So, you know, there's absolutely no true link to combat stress or back-to-back deployments and all these sorts of arguments. But the suicide rate has been very, very high. At the same time, and this is reported by Army Times and Navy Times and military times, the drug use of psychiatric drugs in the military has escalated. And if you put the graphs of the use of the drugs in soldiers over the graph of suicides, they match almost perfectly. Another thing is that enlistment criteria has changed so that people who were already on psychiatric drugs are now allowed to join, whereas at one time that was not the case. So you have people who are being maintained already were on the drugs. But what you have is one out of six soldiers, according to one statistic I read in Army Times, is on psychiatric drugs. Well, as you certainly well know, most of these drugs have prominent suicide warnings, especially for the age group that we're talking about, which would be young adult. And we have the SSRIs are kind of the first drug on which is layered often seizure drugs like a Lyrica or a Neurontin or a Topamax, onto which are layered atypical antipsychotics and more, you know, I'm sure pain drugs and sleep drugs and, anxiety drugs, benzodiazepines. And the result, are cocktails that certainly are never tested. I always say that they're being tested right now in people, you know, because people are the guinea pigs for that. But so the suicide rate has climbed along with these drug cocktails. Some of the prominent VA and DOD personnel, whom your doctors and administrators are unabashedly pharma consultants. And so that's why all these drugs are in these facilities, because it's a revenue stream for big pharma. It's not that these soldiers and veterans are any different than 20 years ago. It's because big pharma's in there. Government funding is the ultimate dream for, that's why they're in Medicare, Medicaid, and VA, and, you know, it's a pharma revenue stream. So as it became more and more apparent that something was wrong with these suicides, the Army in 2010 published an in-depth survey of what was going on, and I think one sentence addressed the SSRIs, which are so commonly used among the troops, and that was a joke, and that was 2010. But more recently, and that's why we're talking about it today, this month in JAMA, Journal of the American Medical Association, was a new look at the suicides. And this was by academic, military, and government researchers who collectively had at least 15 links to Big Pharma, which they listed. And in this analysis of the suicides, they don't even mention the drugs. And to me, it's one thing if you want to mention them and then say, oh, they're not causing the suicides. That's bad enough, but they're not even mentioned in this JAMA article in March.
And consider, folks, that a JAMA article is supposed to be peer-reviewed so that independent eyes look at it. And the journal has responsibility for seeing they don't publish junk science. And yet an article can still come out on suicides in the military without mentioning drugs, even though we've had hearings in 2010 in which I was the, the central presenter, testifier. It started with me for half an hour. The hearings at which the Psychiatric Association came and gave a position, the Veterans Association came and gave a position, and so on and so forth. Even though we had hearings in Congress, and even though there have been a number of us writing about this subject for quite a while, they don't even mention it. It tells you what a lock the pharmaceutical industry has on the heart of medicine, because if medicine has a beating heart, it's got to be journals like the Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA, and those hearts are, they're gone. They've forsaken the truth. It's really a sad situation. It's a rather desperate situation.
Well, these authors declared links to Eli Lilly, who, of course, is known for its psychiatric drugs, GlaxoSmithKline, Johnson & Johnson and Janssen, which is Johnson & Johnson's psychiatric arm, Pfizer, Shire, you know, who of course is the Adderall people or the, you know, ADHD people. And, you know, these were just listed as if it had no bearing on what they reported. And what they reported, it really is just offensive on many levels, certainly to the families of the bereaved. They reported that these problems that drove the soldiers to suicide were pre-existing personality problems. I mean, this is actually what they said. It's criminal. You mentioned with Dr. Volko, you know, that it's bad science. This is just bad science. It's a shock that the variables are not even considered, you know, which is, and it took these people 5 years to come up with the conclusion that we don't really know what's causing these tragic suicides, but it's not the drugs. And so, you know, we have, the Topamax in Neurontin, the Paxil was in the Iraq War Clinician Guides. And it was called clearly effective for combat veterans suffering with PTSD. So this is the first arm of what we're talking about with the military suicides. But the second part that is very, very connected is lyrium. Now, lyrium is a drug for people going to malaria-infested countries. And it was approved in 1989 by the FDA. It was developed at Walter Reed with our tax dollars, and it was given, all the information, all the clinical trial data was given free to Hoffman, LaRoche, and SmithKline. So they say it was the first private-public partnership between Big Pharma and the government. And so lyrium has become, I think they're saying it's still the third most popular malaria drug in the U.S. because it's taken once a week and four of the other five malaria drugs are taken daily. So it has the convenience factor going on. It has a terrible track record. In 2002, I believe it was, in 2002 at Fort Bragg, the summer of 2002, four soldiers killed their wives. And then three of them also killed themselves, and it was very widely reported to be lyrium linked. One soldier in particular stabbed his wife 50 times and set her on fire. And the reason I mention such a graphic example, because I don't even like to bring that up, but it's because the denial machine of Big Pharma and the government and the military literally called these Fort Bragg murders a result of the stress of separation or marital problems. And that's a quote. So, I mean, that is just, you know. Now, more recently, in 2012, many people remember that Sergeant Robert Bales left his outpost in Afghanistan and just, you know, barefoot with a cape on, just in some kind of psychotic stupor, killed 16 Afghan civilians. And even though lyrium was not part of his legal defense, it's now come out that he was under the influence of it. And lyrium, it's been compared to PCP angel dust in the sense that it makes people extremely paranoid, violent, homicidal, suicidal, but also disassociated from themselves. So they almost are having an out-of-body experience, and they, someone else is doing this violence. So it has, there's many, many crimes, certainly not just in military, but in world travelers, Peace Corps workers, aid workers, many examples of violence and also violence against the self with lyrium. And the reason why it is especially concerning, and it's certainly linked with suicide, is also that it, according to the government, does not necessarily leave the body when you go off the drug, and can be permanent changes in the person who took the drug.
Wow. And, you know, the information on lyrium along with violence to itself and others is fairly extensive. This is not a remote thing. What's currently going on with it? Has there been any cutback? My understanding is there's been a cutback in the use of lyrium.
Well, you know, that's a good question. I will give credit to the military, who issued a memo in 2009 that it should be the last choice drug, and then more recently it was forbidden in special forces, elite forces, Green Berets. It's always been forbidden in pilots, thank goodness. To a certain extent, the awareness is there. But what I'm hearing from lyrium action groups is that there's a new drug that's being kind of fast-tracked through to replace lyrium, and they feel that it is possibly going to be just as bad because it's not being tested accurately before it's being brought to the people. And it's like a very similar drug. So it's sort of like the good news, bad news.
Yeah. Well, what else are you looking at now? You've been concerned really about drugs across the board in many different areas, haven't you?
Well, yeah, I haven't just covered the psychiatric drugs, but what I'm very motivated by is false and deceptive marketing and lack of firewalls between government and industry. That's kind of where I focus, because wherever you find corruption and you know, misinformation, that's usually how, you know, the case of these military drugs is a case in point, where, you know, there's a lack of a firewall between, you know, our interests as the public and our public servants and industry. So that's kind of where I focus.
Anything in particular you want to share with us in the last few minutes about the other areas that you've been going into?
Well, I would like to quickly talk about NAMI. I think that some of your
listeners... Well, that's a nice surprise. I haven't heard much about my old nemesis in a while. These people
have been
somewhat violent toward me over the years. The National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, an AstroTurf organization that represents supposedly families of the mentally ill. It represents the drug companies. Tell us about what's the latest with NAMI.
Well, they have a victory. I think we both know, and I'm sure your listeners know, that they're a pharma front. They've been investigated by Congress, as have many of these quote-unquote patient groups. But last month, the Obama administration tried to limit some of the really expensive psychiatric drugs for schizophrenia, depression, from being automatically paid by Medicare, and the estimate that they give is that 33% of Medicare costs are from these brand name drugs, which we know have cheaper, safer alternatives. Well, NAMI and its cohorts stormed Capitol Hill and, you know, began the crocodile tears about, well, you know, poor innocent Medicare beneficiaries won't be able to have their Abilify for $1,200 a month, you know. So they began crying about patient choice, read brand name drugs that pharma wants to sell, and they won. And the Obama administration backed down and said, okay, we'll wave through your expensive drugs, which were, you know, Seroquel and Abilify and Geodon, and I don't remember some of the newer ones, all of which cost more than like what most people pay for rent or mortgage every month.
Yeah, the numbers are astronomical, hundreds and hundreds of dollars a month, what, $700, $800 a month or more. Is that about right?
It is definitely right. And we're paying that as taxpayers, and you know, they're protecting their lifeline. You know, the AstroTurf patient groups pretending that it's a question of patient choice when it's a question of profiteering.
Yeah.
But what I found very upsetting was they won. They won, and Obama administration backed down.
Well, the Obama administration, like every other administration, has lived on drug company money. You know, there's one of the major reasons I think that Obamacare got through is because of promises made to the pharmaceutical industry that they wouldn't be losing any money, including, there's a special provision for reimbursing them or saving them or whatever it's called, bailing them out if Obamacare injures them. This administration has proved, if anything, more adept at using the pharmaceutical industry than earlier folks who tried. This is a cross lines. This is not a Republican, Democrat, or conservative issue. Everybody in power in Washington thrives on the pharmaceutical industry.
And you know, some of the drugs that are still protected until they go off patent are the atypicals, you know, the Seroquel and Risperdal. And, you know, they're very full of corruptions. They're in my book, Born with a Junk Food Deficiency. I hope people will pursue this if they want to know a lot more. But what I always remember is that David Graham, you know, the FDA drug reviewer who blew the whistle on Vioxx, he has talked about how many people every single day in nursing homes are killed by these drugs. You know, so these atypical antipsychotics should never be given to the elderly with dementia, and yet they are. And obviously, this NAMI coup is going to keep this going on. So, you know, they're not innocuous. And what I write in a lot of the pieces about this is that earlier drugs have really been safer. They're certainly cheaper, but they're also safer. And so while pretending that it's a patient choice, patients are actually being injured along with, you know, taxpayers. But it's just criminal that these drugs are allowed to do whatever harm they do until they go off patent.
That is a very interesting observation that and I think you've done a blog about that, about how some of the recognition for adverse effects just escalates after the drugs are off patent. They're not being actively defended anymore by the drug companies. Oh my gosh! Only in America, actually, it's pretty much throughout the world. Money and power have huge effects on everything that goes on around us. It's always the case. Wow. We've got about 7 or 8 minutes left. You know, one of the things that might be worth reminding people about is that these newer antipsychotic drugs, Martha's been mentioning their names, Zyprexa and Risperdal and Seroquel and Latuda, and it goes on, you know, that whole bunch of stuff, Abilify. These drugs have turned out to cause all the harm that the older drugs do. Mm-hmm. And even worse than the older drugs in producing what's called a metabolic syndrome of obesity, diabetes, elevated lipids, that's cholesterol in the bloodstream, heart arrhythmias, a whole package that is literally a prescription for cardiac arrest and death, and they are shortening the lifespan and making quality of life much diminished. These are not safer drugs. They're horrendous drugs. And they pretty much do the same job as the older drugs in causing a lobotomy. So they work about the same, but no better. In fact, in terms of, quote, efficacy, the older drugs a little better because maybe they do a little bit better lobotomy, some of them. Because nothing's better than Risperdal and Zyprexa and a bunch of the new ones than lobotomizing. But, you know, there's really essentially no provable difference between them in their effectiveness. And it's the
well,
same reason
you're
why
absolutely, you're absolutely right. And what I've heard is that, you know, originally they were sold with the idea that they didn't cause a tardive dyskinesia as a side effect, but it turns out that they were just rushed to the market and they weren't tested long enough in you know, phase two or three to show that, in fact, they do cause tardive dyskinesia. You know, they have no advantage over the old ones, and as you say, a lot of worse side effects that hadn't existed with a Haldol or a Thorazine.
Well, in fact, you know, if you go to my website, you'll see the recent legal victory I was involved in, where I was the expert in a case of a 14-year-old autistic child who was given a very severe case of tardive dyskinesia with all the signs of, you know, abnormal movements, but also vocalizations and swallowing, and also just a whole bunch of problems, and finally a horrible, horrible akathisia, which is this inner torture that drives you to move around, and that youngster was exposed to Zyprexa and Risperdal. I mean, there's no question. And while you're right that they didn't test them long enough to see if it would cause tardive dyskinesia, in fact, they knew it would. Because all these drugs are dopamine blockers.
And so how can they not? Right.
They could not know because all dopamine blockers cause tardive dyskinesia. So they, Martha, my listeners, they had to know. I knew. I just looked at what they did, and I knew they were going to cause a lot of TD because they are powerful. Most of them are powerful dopamine blockers. Others not so powerful, but still dopamine blockers. And all the dopamine blockers cause tardive dyskinesia, and the potentially lethal neuroleptic malignant syndrome, which is like very similar to an attack of viral encephalitis. And this was all obvious from just reading in the physician's desk reference or in the FDA-approved description of the drug, that they were dopamine blockers. It was obvious from the beginning. So
and another thing that I'm sure you're aware of is back before the direct-to-consumer advertising and before the marketing frenzy, they wouldn't take one of these drugs like the Thorazine or the Melaril, and they wouldn't turn around and say, okay, this is for your depression or this is for PMS. They didn't. Now, you know, they've taken these new ones like the Seroquel, and now they're trying to find more mild uses for it to extend, patents.
Yeah.
And so
we got to finish up now. We're talking with Martha Rosenberg, who does a lot of really good work. You can find her on the internet. One last word, which is that it all began with these drugs being used for everything. Thorazine originally, Smith, Klein, and French put out a book about using it for everything from nausea in pregnant women to anxiety in pregnant women. And that was squelched. But it just comes around again with the power of the drug companies. Martha, thank you. Martha Rosenberg, thank you for being on the show again. You're a breath of fresh air. And you are an investigative reporter.
Thank you so much, and thank you for your good work, your followers, your radio show, and your books. And thank you for spending this time talking about these topics with me.
You're very, very welcome. Good night, folks. Keep coming back. I love you. I love this audience. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.